I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Pope Francis enters the climate debate next week. Stage left, in the narrowest political terms, he is for global activism in a clear emergency. His mission, though, is transformation. First, to inject moral, emotional, universal urgency into the numbers and the news that mostly numb us. The storms, the temperatures, the parts per million of carbon in the sky. And then he would rebuild the apparatus that seems to be broken for making life and death choices for the human species. Around the gift, he would say, in the broadest religious terms, the gift of God's creation. The Pope will be saying things that scientists and politicians cannot seem to, and the relief is palpable on the bridge between faith and those cold numbers. Here is a sample of Catholics coming out of church in Boston this week.
For the Pope to be saying this, he's not a scientist. I mean, he's a Jesuit, he's a smart guy.
He speaks to me on a spiritual basis, very big part of my moral compass.
We're informed. Scientists are informed. The faith community is informed by each other, and I think there's a richness there. There is a moral component.
I have a 3.5-year-old grandson, and I have been snorkeling in places in the Atlantic where the reefs are dead.
But we should not freak out about the planet.
God wants us to love each other. For me, that includes not just loving human beings, but loving all of our neighbors, sentient or non-sentient.
Be careful you don't care more about animals and the planet than about humans.
The Earth is our home. If we allow ourselves to continue living the way that we do, heedless of how our habits of consumption, our habits of production of the goods that we need, cause destruction to all of our living neighbors on this planet, we're frustrating God's plan and design for creation. We're continually crucifying Christ, but think of it now on a cosmic scale. And this is something that has to create a feeling of distress for Christians.
We're looking this hour at a sharp turn in the climate conversation, and the Pope's part in it has just begun. In late September, he will address Congress and then the United Nations. He's setting a high bar and a new key for the UN Climate Change Conference in Paris in December. The last ones in Kyoto and then Copenhagen stumbled badly. We will begin with the Harvard historian of science, Naomi Oreskes, who has been drawn into the drafting of the Pope's encyclical. Then Sally Weintraub in London. She's a psychoanalyst of the climate blind spot in our heads. And then Dorothy Bourse of Gordon College in Wenham, where she teaches biology and writes about loving man, the planet, and God in the same framework. Naomi Oreskes, welcome. Take us with you into the Vatican. How did it come to this, that a scientist and climate warrior like yourself is part of the Pope's intervention to kick climate upstairs, as we've been saying?
Thank you for asking. It's a pleasure to be here. So last year, I had the extraordinary experience, really the privilege of being invited to the Vatican, along with about 40 other scientists and social scientists from around the globe, to a workshop sponsored by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences on the question of climate change in relation to sustainability. The title of the conference was Sustainable Nature, Sustainable Humanity, Our Responsibility. Mm. And it was a fascinating meeting because many of us were not actually quite sure why we were there, but we all felt that an opportunity to be inside the Vatican was one we wouldn't pass up. And so there was a lot of whispering when we arrived about exactly what this was about. And the word on the street was there was a possibility that, in fact, the Pope would develop an encyclical on the environment and climate change. And indeed, we learned as the meeting went on that that was the plan, and now it's about to come to fruition. So it's a very exciting moment.
So what's the drive? What's the language? What's the thinking? I mean, and do we, do you believe it?
Wait, do I believe what? That there's climate change?
That the Pope knows
the Pope
what he's talking about. Does he know the numbers? Does he know the science?
Well, we know he knows what he's talking about because he has had advice on the very, very highest level from some of the most famous and respected climate scientists in the world. And I haven't personally discussed the science with the Pope, but I have discussed it with the people who have discussed it. So I'm one degree of separation? So we know that the Pope has sat down and spent time with the world's leading climate scientist. And yes, he has the facts, he has the figures, and we have every reason to believe that he understands what the science is saying. But what he brings to it is this other crucial dimension of what the science means for people, for justice, and for its impacts on humanity.
And let's never forget that he has a constituency in the Global South. I mean, billions of poor people, which is important.
Absolutely. Well, any pope has a huge constituency just by virtue of being pope. But the unique thing that this pope has brought into the public conversation is a reminder of the basic fundamental Christian ideas of care for the poor and the, you know, the less well-off. And Pope Francis, even in taking the name Francis, you know, signaled from the very beginning that that was going to be a central focus of his papacy.
He's building on an extensive record of his own bold talk. I mean, speaking as a South American, he has said that the commercial ruin of forests amounts to a sin of exploitation. He says one of the great challenges of this time is to convert ourselves to a type of development that knows how to respect creation. It's man, he has said, who keeps slapping nature in the face. He said he's also got us in his sights, us Americans, especially the environmental foot draggers. He says we Americans have an economic system that plunders nature to feed a frenetic system of consumption. Those are his words, not to mention profits. I mean, this is strong language, and it's going to be a fight.
Yes, absolutely. So I think this is crucial on so many levels, because in the United States, if I said that we had a frenetic system of consumption, well, I have said things like that.
Do you have tenure?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I get accused of being a communist. It's very difficult to have any conversation in the United States where we talk about our patterns of consumption and our way of life without being accused of being un-American. You may remember some years ago, Dick Cheney famously said the American way of life is not up for negotiation.
But even President Obama in his first inauguration said, we're not about to apologize for our way of life. This is...
Right. And I think one of the things that's beautiful about what the Pope is doing is he's trying to invite us into a conversation and remind us that everything is negotiable on some level. It's always appropriate for us to be thinking about what our actions are and what the consequences of our action are. So if we frame it not as an attack on the American way of life, but a conversation about responsibility and our obligation to care for our home, for each other, for our fellow citizens of the United States and the globe. It's a different way of saying the same thing, but hopefully a different way that I think can resonate with people, because most of us get it. Most of us care about taking care of our homes. We wouldn't burn down our house. So why would we burn down our planetary home?
I'm struck by those Catholics coming out of church we just heard. These are not difficult ideas to get your head around. People of good conscience want to do the right thing. But I'm interested in the scientists meeting the church folk. The Pope is inviting people into a kind of reconciliation of two truths, realms of truths, science and religion, the realms of is and ought, or morality facing the real world. Is science in on this kind of let's find a new language project?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this really is an extraordinary moment in many ways. And one of the ways it's extraordinary that I particularly appreciate as a historian of science is this rather surprising and some might even say, you know, shocking development that you have scientists, most of whom are secular, many of whom are, if they have spiritual feelings, they're not conventionally religious. Most of the climate scientists I know don't go to church on Sunday or synagogue on Saturday or Friday night. But you have these people waiting with bated breath for the Pope to speak, and all of these scientists, you know, almost giddy, you know, wide-eyed at the opportunity to meet the Pope and to be part of this thing and, you know, very excited and happy to work with the Vatican. That's a remarkable development when you stop to think
about
it.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
Science has a new sort of communications director.
Yes. So if you ask yourself, well, what state of affairs has brought us to this place where scientists are now eagerly awaiting a papal encyclical, I think it tells you something about the way in which scientists have felt stuck. Scientists know this is a moral issue. I mean, you won't surprise a climate scientist by saying this is a moral issue. Scientists have in private been saying that for 30 years, even longer, really. But scientists don't know how to talk about morality. It's not in the domain of science. It's not a topic of science. And it's not something that you can prove with evidence. So even though scientists know this is a moral issue, they haven't really known how to speak in that kind of language. But now the Pope comes and says, well, I am a moral authority and I can speak in that kind of language. In fact, that is my language. And I think scientists feel an almost palpable sense of relief that
I was going to say, are you typical, do you think, of the fraternity of science?
In what way?
Well, just in this relief, this kind of celebration. We have another way to, and we've not sold a change in policy, and we now have critically important new help.
Every climate scientist I know who I've spoken to about this issue is very excited about this development. And yes, I think feels a sense of either relief or cautious optimism, a kind of hopefulness that the Pope coming to talk about this issue may make a difference in a way that what we've done up until now has not.
I keep thinking just in this week of the late wonderful Michael Dertouzis at MIT, a computer pioneer, and he said to us on the radio one time, I don't forget it, that we have an enlightenment bug in our culture that has separated the technologists from the humanitarian, from the humanists, from faith-based people. And in most of the life of our species, these were three states of mind in one head. The techies, the humies, the faithies, we didn't segregate them before. And he was a Greek Orthodox computer scientist, and he wanted to change our all our connections. And I think the Pope is sort of outlining a way to do it. Is that plausible?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think this one encyclical will resolve all of the many complicated aspects of the interrelations of science, religion, humanism, technology. But I do think it is a reminder to us that all of the really important problems of life are problems simultaneously of facts and values.
Keep going.
Well, and just, I mean, so to have a new way of thinking about how to talk about both the science and the values, the facts and the implications, I do think that's something that's really culturally important for us. And if this helps us move in that direction, that will be a hugely beneficial thing.
We're talking with Naomi Oreskes and others about the Pope's dramatic entry into the climate conversation. Coming up, is there a bug in our brains that won't let us deal with something as big and scary as the climate? Our psychiatrist in London says, not exactly. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on the climate conversation that Pope Francis is about to reshape. Sally Weintraub is a psychiatrist with a practice in London. She has made a specialty of the gap between what we know about the climate crisis and what we're ready and willing to do about it. We asked her in a Skype call this week to diagnose the problem.
One of the very big problems at the moment is what I'm calling the culture of uncare. It's a culturally driven mindset that I think has been driven by the global economy in this period of deregulation and globalization. The problem is not globalization. The problem is that it was driven by a particular mindset that sort of privileges short-termism, not having to count the cost, outsourcing suffering and profit. In a way, if you look at it like that, and I think that's what Pope Francis is talking about in his language, which is pretty similar, actually. The problem for a project like that is that if one looks at it in those terms, it's an immoral project and it's also unsustainable. So how was this enterprise going to get going without our cooperation? It must have our cooperation, otherwise it won't succeed. And I think that's where the culture comes in. I think that we have been subjected to a particular relentless boosting of a particular mindset over the last few decades. And in order for us to really appreciate what's needed now, we have to, I think, see the force of this mindset and the effect that it's had on us. And I think it affects all of us, you know. And in particular, it encourages us to believe that we can have anything we want right now from anywhere in the world, and we don't have to be troubled by guilt or anxiety, and we can outsource the suffering. And I think that the culture, what it does is it serves a sort of ideological function of enabling us to think like that and not be too disturbed. Really, to put it another way, it's a culture that helps us to turn a blind eye. at the same time, being in a bit of a bubble, we think there's nothing amiss and we can carry on like this, we are also getting more and more anxious so that we can't even look at the problem.
Sally Weintraub, jump into this gap between what we know and what we do. I mean, rational people in California, on the Gulf Coast, in Texas, on the New Jersey coast, in the United States, know perfectly well that something awful is happening before our eyes. Somebody said, if this problem were a bank, we'd be bailing it out by now. I say if it were Ramadi or if ISIS, would have declared war on it. What is it that prevents us from acting here?
Well, I return to the culture. I think that it drives a state of dissociation between a part of us that actually cares and a part of us that's caught up with what I call this uncaring short-termist mindset. It's a power relationship between those two parts. I think what our culture encourages is that just at the last moment, uncare will triumph. You know, I can give you one example of myself, you know, finding myself in the supermarket. I'm very involved with climate change. I try to do my bit. I try to lessen my emissions as much as possible. So one part of that is I don't buy flown in fresh fruit and vegetables because I'm very aware of the carbon price tag. And then I find myself in the supermarket and it's late and there are people coming to supper and there's the shelf. And I think, despite all this, I actually think, oh, well, I'm just going to do it. And then I find myself having a bit of an argument with myself and I say, no, you know, I can't do anything else. And then I noticed, and this is something that really has preoccupied me recently, I noticed that there's a kind of shadowy group of my friends in my mind and they all support me buying the vegetables. And they say things like, oh, come on, don't be so hard on yourself, Sally. You don't have any other options. This is ridiculous. Do you think that by your one little action, it's going to make any difference at all? You know, the problem is structural. And all these arguments start mounting up and they drown a kind of a clear moment when I am thinking to myself, actually, I don't want to be doing this. I know it's harmful. Now, those kind of voices could be helpful. They could be saying, look, okay, learn from your mistake. Next time, take more time and think differently. Think it through. You know, this is an ongoing project to reduce emissions. But I sense the group is not that kind of group. It's actually supporting a position that I've got, which is a very entitled position. It says, you know, I'm late. This is an important thing. I'm a very busy person and I'm somehow entitled to behave like this. And I think the group in my mind, this is a group in my mind, you know, I think it does correspond very accurately to a lot of my friends in the world, but it's also something that I've taken in and I use it to support a position of not caring. So it's a complex area because, you know, it's not just what's being done to us. It's how we relate to that and how we collude with it and get into these relationships with the culture. I don't think it's easy for people to really confront this problem and work it through. And I think they need help and understanding and support to do that.
You speak about the short-term, uncaring culture. Did our species ever have a real long-term and caring culture? And did we ever need one before?
We do know that there are models of care. It's got its deep roots in us. I would agree with you there. It doesn't go deep enough to say that this is a problem with capitalism. It's a much, much older problem than this. It's the problem in a way of the fantasy of the inexhaustible breast, that the earth is really kind of a breast toilet, you know, provides endlessly in an ideal way, and it then receives all our waste. So I think the human race is being encouraged to grow up. There has been a relentlessness over the last few decades, you know, since the late 70s, when this globalization project took off, that has actually driven uncare considerably. You see, I think there's uncare in our nature, which is always in a struggle with care. That's our human legacy. But I think that this culture has relentlessly pushed the uncare, and it has attacked the structures of care and has exacerbated the problem. Most of our mass media is relentlessly driving disavowal of climate change.
For example, where do you see that?
I'll give you an example. When was the New York Hurricane Sandy. Obama got reelected. In his inaugural address, he mentioned climate change. It was really important. I mean, because we've got a real failure of leadership. He actually mentioned it. Now, what gets reported is Beyoncé lip-synced the national anthem. When Sandy happened, a lot of us were looking at the pattern of reporting. It was not linked to climate change. In hardly any cases was it linked to climate change. And when it was, there was a sort of a chorus of media voices saying, oh, well, you know, that's scientifically wrong. You can't link weather to climate change. Now, you can't. But if you don't go on to say, yes, but this is the pattern that scientists are predicting, then it's disavowal. So it's not just a question of us as individuals, whether we're brave enough to confront a culture or to stand up. What we need to be doing is seeing the massive effect of this culture on us.
Sally Weintraub, I wonder what you make of this strange convergence of the Pope and science, the Church of England too, from entirely different philosophical bases toward a similar place. This feels vaguely historic.
I think it's not vaguely historic. I think it's a tremendously historic moment, actually, for the Pope to be issuing this encyclical.
When the G7 powers say we've got to be carbon free by the end of the century, do you take heart? Are we convertible?
I think I take the sort of heart that Bill McKibben was voicing on Twitter yesterday. He's not jumping for joy, because I think that there's a deferment of the urgency of the problem in that. So I don't take very much heart from that. I think they're going to need a lot more pushing than that.
That was Dr. Sally Weintraub in London. In our studio, Naomi Oreskes is just going back. I think you would argue that the bug in our brain here between understanding and action was planted there.
Right. Well, I really appreciate Sally's comments, and I really agree with what she said about the culture of uncare. What I would add to it, though, would be the question, how has this culture of uncare so strengthened in the last 30 to 40 years? And the piece of this that I would add to the discussion is really the book that I wrote, the 2010 book with Eric Conway, Merchants of Doubt, where we documented the way in which a systematic pattern of denial of the problem had been promulgated by think tanks linked to the fossil fuel industry and to other regulated industries who promoted the idea that there wasn't really a problem, that the problem was exaggerated, that people who said there was a problem were socialists and communists who were un-American, and that scientists were arguing about it anyway. So it's linked. This question of a culture of uncare is linked to it's linked to neoliberalism. It's linked to the pushing of markets as solutions to all our problems. But it's been done by people who have a vested interest in persuading us that we don't have a problem, persuading us that we don't need to constrain our use of these resources because they are the ones who benefit from the unconstrained use of fossil fuels.
And persuading us that we're, in a fashion, helpless. I want to introduce Dorothy Bors in our studio. She's a marine biologist by training. She's a Christian in her spirit life with a Mennonite tilt, I take it, towards simple living and justice. Dorothy Bors, you've been in a running conversation with evangelical Christians, gospel Christians, on environmental ethics. How does it go?
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here. And I would say it's a mixed bag. And I have some happy things to report. And they support the idea that throughout Christian history, there has been a thread of caring for the environment. And there's that's supported way back. And it's re-emerging, I think, in the vocabulary people are using. And in general, that means that Christians are supporting the idea that caring for the environment means honoring God by taking care of your neighbor by not allowing environmental degradation to occur. However, not everybody, of course, you read the news too, not everybody's on board with that. And I think there's some barriers, and some of them have to do with this general conversation between scientists and people of faith. And I think that's sort of an exciting place to be in both. I've sort of seen as a scientist the scientific community feeling like they need to communicate better, and there are groups in the faith community trying to use good science to better understand the world. So the Evangelical Environmental Network, for example, tries to give out information, and the National Association of Evangelicals put out a report I got to be a part of called Loving the Least of These, Addressing a Changing Environment. That was a couple of years ago, and that was to try and put a human face on climate change, to make that link in people's minds between, oh, wow, you know, sea level rise is real, it's happening, it's not in the future, it's right now, and there are people really harmed by that. And all
that's
of the
justice
other
piece, and the Pope is mm-hmm. going to come down strong yes. on it, apparently. But first, go back to the book of Genesis. So these two notions, dominion and stewardship. Dominion is the notion that God gave Adam authority over the land and the animals mm-hmm. and a special place to us and our species, which sounds like sort of carte blanche. But then there's also the notion of stewardship, that we are answerable mm-hmm. for this gift. And it's ours, sort of, and the big guy's watching. Is there a doctrinal difference there, attention?
I do think there's a difference between people that interpret the same scripture different ways. And that's probably true in Jewish tradition as well. But many Christians do believe that that dominion actually is not a carte blanche at all, in part because later on in the scriptures, especially in the Psalms, God is always listed as the owner. Nothing was given over to humans, like, here, go do what you want. In fact, there's very clear description that we will be called on the carpet for what we do in our lives generally, especially in the care of the poor and the oppressed, but also I think in the way we use resources. And that's a pretty consistent thread in both the Hebrew Bible and in the teachings of Christ. The stewardship model is actually a lot more resonant with the way that Genesis is describing. In fact, the words for what Adam was to do in the garden are the words that would be translated tend and serve. And so you to be tending and serving, not taking advantage of. But a lot of times, like, one of the people that was interviewed said something about don't care more about the environment than people. And let me just say, this isn't just about climate change. Climate change is a risk multiplier, but the environment needs attention from everybody right now on every level. So it is really difficult as a scientist who pays attention to these things to hear somebody say something like that, because if you don't care about the environment, you don't care about people. There are 550 dead zones where nothing can live in that ocean. And there are 6 giant patches of floating debris in the ocean. And this year, 90% of the monarchs are gone. So I feel like just saying, wake up, people. This isn't about people versus the environment. In fact, a 2008 report said that if we don't stop the loss of species, the poorest billion people might lose as much as half of their income because they're the people that depend on wild species. So if you look at air pollution, if you look at water pollution, if you look at loss of species, if you look at every global planetary boundary, every one of them needs our attention. And in fact, it affects people very directly.
But how does a Christian intervene in this stuck argument between jobs and environmental degradation?
Well, honestly, if you really cared about jobs, you'd fight a system where 85 people in the world have as much wealth as 3.2 billion people. Like, obviously, there's all sorts of things that don't work in the world that we live in. To argue that we should let environmental degradation occur to protect jobs is sort of not looking at the other things that might be protecting jobs.
Naomi,
yeah, and if I can jump in here, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that has happened in this culture of uncare, as Sally calls it, is that there's been the propagation of a number of big lies. And one of the biggest lies is this lie that it's the environment versus jobs. In every area where there have been studies that have looked at this question, they almost invariably find that environmental protection generates jobs. And I've studied the question of what the Montreal Protocol, which was the protocol that protected the ozone layer, has done in terms of jobs. The World Bank and the UN have all studied this question, and many more jobs were created by the protocol than were destroyed. Now, sometimes it is true that there are short-term dislocations, and we have to be concerned about the people who in the short run may, in fact, be dislocated or affected. But it's just a myth. It's a big lie that protecting the environment damages jobs. And it relates to what Dorothy has just been saying. The other big myth is that this is about people or versus polar bears. And I felt the same way. I wanted to cry when that little girl said, you should care more about people, you know, than animals. It's the same. It's a false dichotomy. When we protect the environment, when we protect monarch butterflies, we protect our pollinators, and that means we protect ourselves.
Dorothy Bush, quick line before the break on that.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly what she said.
we'll be back. Talking about The Guardian, Britain online to the world is signaling a media turn on the climate, including this mind meld of science and church. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. As the Vatican weighs in on the climate of planet Earth, on the same subject, there's been a fascinating turn also in British journalism. The many ways remarkable Alan Rusbridger, facing retirement as editor of The Guardian newspaper and website, has been waging a multimedia campaign to wake the world to a threat of death.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people. And this is a story about possibility. The story.
It's a podcast series that keeps coming back to a single theme, that burning all the Earth's buried coal, oil, and gas will kill the climate.
This stuff has to be kept in the ground. It cannot be dug up. And therefore, if you want one focus for what The Guardian should do, it should be about keeping the stuff in the ground.
Keep it in the ground.
In a recent episode, ahead of the Pope's climate encyclical, The Guardian drew the Church of England into the moral dimension of the story, centering now on the Church of Rome.
Because the Roman Catholic Church is incomparably the largest transnational organization in the world, it will probably have some influence. So I would expect a document excoriating greed, excoriating the workings of multinational capitalism, as they presently think, and suggesting or demanding a simpler lifestyle and one in which globally there is a considerable transfer of resources from the rich to the poor.
Beyond religion, Alan Rusbridger is looking for levers in other non-scientific places, like art.
You know, if you believe that art and artists are there to say powerful and deep things about our condition, then they're very good people to, and natural people to approach.
You can hear more on The Guardian's climate story at theguardian.com. In our studio, Naomi Oreskes, geologist, and Dorothy Boris, biologist and Mennonite. The question is, now what? Are you feeling a new traction for action here in an American context where the Congress, the media, a lot of the business class have been pretty nearly inert on climate questions? Naomi.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's hard to know for sure. It's a very complicated issue. And as you say, Washington is gridlocked on this issue. But in many places, we are seeing a lot of interesting developments. So I consider myself a Californian. California has AB 32, the emissions control law that commits California to carbon dioxide reductions as if it were a member signatory to the Kyoto Protocol. So that's a huge development. And then, of course, in the business world, we're seeing a lot of discussion in the business world about what's needed to move forward, including support in many quarters of the business community for divestment from fossil fuels. And to me, that's the most remarkable thing that has happened this year. So when the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, which is, after all, the descendants of John D. Rockefeller, himself, the original oil man himself, right? When that fund said they were going to divest their foundation holdings from fossil fuels, well, that made it to the front page of the New York Times for good reason, because I think that was a kind of a crucial moment where I think the message was, we can't keep on doing what we've been doing and expect it to come out all right in the end.
Dorothy Boris, I wonder what you think. You have to be reminded of Hitler's famous question, how many divisions has the Pope? How many votes in Congress does the Pope turn? What's new in the action campaign?
I'm not sure I could answer that directly, but I have been sort of concerned by the comments of some people in Congress who are Catholic who have not wanted to align with the Pope on this. And so when Rick Santorum recently said, don't listen to the Pope on climate change, I was like, well, shoot, I'm listening to the Pope on climate change.
He must be a cafeteria Catholic.
but I will say this. I am very excited about what's happening with young people. And so I'm associated with a group called Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. I know some of the people involved with that. And last September got to march in the People's Climate March with 350,000 people just marching in the streets in New York City. And I was marching in a section with scientists and people of faith communities were put together in the same section. And next to me were all these people in their scientific clothes, and then on the other side were people carrying these banners, and people from the Christian Reformed Church, Office of Social Justice, and just all sorts of communities came together for that. The other thing that really also I'm really excited about is what people are doing on community levels. And if you looked at all the coastal states, for example, and then you look at the states with a lot of forestry, all of those states, they're trying to come up with climate action plans. Like the town of Danvers has a climate action plan. Boston has, you know, plans. New York City just had this giant contest to try and figure out how to make New York City less climate sensitive. And there's going to be a lot more of that. Like, it's almost like on the community level, we know this is happening. But on the government level, we're having trouble.
We sure are. I mean, even President Obama, there he is, you know, opening the Arctic Circle for oil drilling. The Congress completely out of the conversation. They do make the rules still.
Mm-hmm. Well, they make the rules in the federal level, but they don't make the rules on the state and local level. And a lot of social change and political change in this country has come from the states and local governments. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important beacon of hope to remember that and to know that there's a lot of power on the state level.
Meantime, you mentioned the divestment drive, and it's getting more and more interesting. Stanford University has taken its endowment out of coal. The Rockefeller family, as you say, out of fossil fuels, of all things. Norway, the nation, the Massachusetts Treasury are both divesting. Also, the People's Republic of Cambridge, that's easy, and other college towns.
But not yet the People's Republic of Harvard.
No. But you want to feel a tipping point here, or at least in prospect, as the Pope weighs in. What do you think?
I think the Norwegian divestment is an incredibly interesting moment because Norway is a country that still has substantial North Sea oil resources, and they're not proposing to leave those in the ground. But yet at the same time, it shows us that as a country, they get it, that this is a big problem. And so I think I see Norway as just this incredibly interesting, in a way, microcosm for the rest of the world, that this is a dilemma. It's like Sally said, we're trying to do the right thing, but it's not easy. But you have to make a step, and you have to begin somewhere. And the fact that your initial step may not be totally logically coherent, in a way, I think doesn't really matter. And I think that is part of the argument for divestment. No, we can't just stop using fossil fuels tomorrow, but we have to begin to stop. We have to begin to make the transition to a non-fossil fuel-based economy. And I see the argument for divestment as being both moral and practical and pragmatic. The moral argument is that we have to stop profiting from something which is going to cause tremendous suffering. But the pragmatic argument is that we have to stop investing in new fossil fuel resources and infrastructure. And so in that case, doing what's right in terms of economics and profits is actually right in terms of preventing suffering as well.
I'm still amazed at the turnaround that's required in our thinking. It used to be, I mean, just yesterday, people would say, are we running out of oil? Are we running out of oil? Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, we're all saying, can we leave it in the ground, please? Can we abandon it? Can we forget it? Yeah. Can we stop thinking of grinding up mountains to fuel our overconsumption?
Yeah, well, this one's close to my heart because I'm a geologist by training. And this is one of the things that breaks my heart about the media, because I was trained as a geologist. We never, ever said that we were running out of oil in the world. We said we were running out of oil in the United States. And even that, what we said was, what M. King Hubbard said, was that we were reaching peak oil in the United States. And he was right about that. Scientists did not get this wrong. They got it right. And in fact, Alvin Weinberg, who I studied, who was the head of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, in 1973 said, in the pages of Science magazine, we will have to stop using fossil fuels because of climate change long before we actually run out of them. So scientists actually got this one right, but it was very misreported and misrepresented in the media. And so a lot of people now have the impression that scientists got this all wrong, and that impression is not true.
In our little gang, we've been wondering, is there a rebranding of the terms here that would make the Pope's very un-American line somehow acceptable in Congress? And we're thinking about the turnabout, still pretty amazing, around gay rights and gay marriage. What began back at Stonewall not so long ago as a sort of matter of niche rights for an embattled minority changed entirely when the keywords became love, family, tolerance, equality. What would be the equivalent rephrasing of the climate issue to take the sting or the curse out of it?
Well, it occurs to me that several years ago, the Evangelical Environmental Network ran the What Would Jesus Drive campaign, and that was focused on lowering our use of gasoline and getting people on board that mattered. And so I would say it depends on the group that you're working with, but you know, one thing that really struck me when we were listening to Sally, when you were interviewing Sally, was her comment about how difficult it is as an individual. And I feel like we need to stop putting good-hearted individuals in the position of standing in the grocery store, having to make decisions that are right against their own best interests financially. And what we really need is to make things cost what they actually cost. Mm-hmm. And if the cost of something includes tremendous devastation to the environment and literally millions of people being harmed, then it should be a very hard thing to do. But instead, it's the easier thing to do. You actually have to do something terrifyingly difficult every day to decide not to buy into this. But I think if we looked back at, like, the Depression, I was struck by people talking about the American way of life. My grandmother would not have recognized that American way of life. You know, today we waste 40% of the food in America is wasted. Mm. Nobody from the Depression would have thought that was acceptable. No, people didn't do that. My grandparents saved the tinfoil. They saved tinfoil when the Depression was over.
Mind you.
We all have grandparents like that. But if you go back to them and you say, nobody cooks real food and everything is sprayed, if you just described the world, they would not say that's the American way of life.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And if I could add to that, I think there are a lot of words that we can use that will resonate with many people. Fairness, justice, right. Responsibility, accountability, the true cost, what paying for things, what they really cost. And also one more I want to add, which is happiness. Because I think the really, really crucial crux of this whole thing, right, because we all want to be happy, we have all this stuff and it hasn't made us happier.
Oh, that's true too. Yeah.
I didn't ask you, but I got to. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say in this crisis?
Small question.
I think
he'd have a zip car by now.
I think that Jesus would say, caring for the environment is a part of honoring God and caring for your neighbor. And those are the two great commandments. So go and do it.
Meantime, I'm intrigued. There's been a little culture war running in the background, especially in university world, about science crowding out the humanities, some concern about anti-scientism too. But I'm taking a lesson here, and I want to try it out on you, that one of the things we're learning in the climate story is that science does not lead the way, and it can't even speak for itself without the magical human terms that the Pope has reintroduced. Life, love, stewardship, sin, truth, human reality, moral responsibility. Am I right, Naomi?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a mantra for a long time in my own life, which is that facts are not enough. They're necessary, but they're not sufficient. And I think this is one of the reasons why climate scientists have had so much trouble communicating on this issue, because it's so fact-oriented. You said at the beginning, you know, millimeters of sea level rise or degrees centigrade. I mean, people don't even know what degrees centigrade are. But even if they did, it wouldn't be very meaningful to most people. So we have all these facts. We have thousands and thousands of pages of reports crammed with information. But it hasn't really communicated to people what's at stake or why this matters, or why they as individuals should care. So again, that brings us back to the Pope. The Pope's message is really a message about why this matters for people, for plants, for animals, and for all the interconnections between us and the plants and animals that we share the world with.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the relief in just hearing a moral leader who's got the title speaking these terms after so much, you know, so many suits talking so many numbers, especially around markets and trade-offs. And Dorothy?
Well, Protestant Christians don't have a hierarchical structure that would be anything like the Roman Catholic Church. I know that the Orthodox Church also has had a lot of speaking about green issues, environment, and environmental care. And I think it's much more distributed discussion. And I sort of wish we did have.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not really wishing that. But for whatever, it would be nice to have a clearer voice, more coherent voice over in the Protestant world that I'm inhabiting. But I'm also a scientist, and I'm really happy to say that my own society, the Ecological Society of America, has a special speakers bureau to faith communities. And the AAAS has an organizational effort to speak to faith communities as well.
So interesting. I mean, we don't want to leap to conclusions, but we're somehow all feeling better. Thank you, Dorothy Boris, Naomi Oreskes, and in London, Sally Weintraub. We're going out on the music and words of John Luther Adams, the Alaskan composer behind the Pulitzer Prize-winning piece for large symphony orchestra titled Become Ocean.
I think what I want to be in touch with for myself, and perhaps to invite you as the listener to be in touch with, is something larger, deeper, older than we are. In the 19th century, they called it the sublime, that razor's edge between beauty and terror. And I've been on that edge myself, you know, living 40 years in Alaska, in the presence of massive tidewater glaciers breaking off, calving into the sea and sending out these enormous waves full of building-sized bergs of ice, or in the presence of wildfire. These are unimaginable forces, and in the presence of those forces, we're so small. It's frightening. It can be overwhelming and terrifying, and yet at the same time, it's kind of it's close to a religious experience as I get.
Search out more climate shows on our website, radioopensource.org, with the likes of Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and Jeremy Grantham. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno, with help from Marquise Neal. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Mother Superior. I'm Christopher Lydon.